These are the Greek Myth Files, a close look into the Greek mythical story world, its gods, its heroes, and its monstrous others. Each episode features a story or broader topic that we dig into, analyze, and try to explain in a smart but accessible way. They are brought to you by the Classics Program at the University of New Hampshire and its crack team of undergraduates. I'm your host, Professor Scott Smith. Over 4 months ago, on September 8, 2023, a major earthquake struck Morocco, causing nearly 3,000 deaths and bringing down many buildings in Marrakech and elsewhere. By one estimate, it caused a reduction of 8% of the country's GDP. It was and remains a devastating tragedy. Morocco is rather prone to earthquakes, though this was the largest in the area since 1900, over 120 years ago. The epicenter was located in the Atlas Mountains, which is home to a number of faults along what is known as the African Plate, and the Atlas Mountains were formed through multiple stages where tectonic plates collided and sent the earth soaring ever upward. It is a lofty mountain range, with its highest peak over 13,000 feet high. Although it is less than half the height of the highest mountain on Earth, Mount Everest, or Chomolungma or Sargamartha, to the local indigenous populations, the Atlas Mountains are 4,000 feet higher than Mount Olympus, the highest mountain in Greece and location of the Olympian gods. In other words, for the Greeks and later Romans, it was a towering feature at the edge of the Earth. It's no wonder, then, that the Greeks and Romans were fascinated by this mountain range on the edge of the earth and suggested that it was here that the mythical giant Atlas held up the sky. In this episode, we'll discuss the origins of Atlas, his myth, and his association with this specific geographical area. And since we're on something of a metamorphosis kick, we'll return to Ovid yet again. And finally, we'll consider the legacy of Atlas and the echoes still felt in the modern world. Atlas as a mythical being first shows up in Hesiod's Theogony, that impressive genealogical catalog of mythical figures. The Theogony starts from creation and moves forward in time, and around the middle of the work, we find a discussion of the sons of the titan Iapetus. Iapetus is nothing more than a cipher, hardly more than a name, but you may have heard of his four sons, or at least some of them. Prometheus, perhaps the most famous. Epimetheus. The obscure Menoetius. And of course, the subject of this episode, Atlas. At any rate, Hesiod doesn't give us a lot to go on, but he calls Atlas a son of invincible spirit, who, by harsh necessity, supports the broad sky on his head and unwearying limbs at the end of the earth, near the clear-voiced Hesperides. This is the doom decreed for him by Zeus the Counselor. So, even at this early period, perhaps around 700 BC, Atlas was associated with the far ends of the earth. Homer's Odyssey, which is probably a bit later than Hesiod, also mentions Atlas, here as the father of the goddess Calypso, the one that keeps Odysseus amused on her island for 7 years. Homer describes Atlas standing in the sea and holding up pillars that keep earth and heaven apart. The sea here may be a reference to ocean, which according to the Greeks was a giant river that ran around the occupied world in a circle. Although it's not exactly clear where Atlas is supposed to be, the Hesperides mentioned by Hesiod may give us a clue etymologically. The word Hesperos is the Greek word for evening, and thus west, because that's where the sun sets. Hesperos is related to the word Vespers, or evening prayers, in the Catholic Church, which comes from a related Latin word. Anyways, the location in the west is confirmed in a 5th century BC tragedy of unknown authorship called The Prometheus Bound, where the lead character, Prometheus, informs us that his brother stands in the west, propping up the column of heaven and earth on his shoulders. No one tells us explicitly why Atlas has suffered such a heavy punishment, but it's pretty clear from the context in Hesiod and The Prometheus Bound that Atlas had opposed Zeus as king of the gods and suffered for it. Although the etymology of the name Atlas, or Atlas, is contested, it seems likely that the tla part of the word is related to the Indo-European word to bear to carry, or to endure. Looking at these early texts, we see that Atlas had human features, was powerful enough and apparently big enough to carry the weight of the heavens on his shoulders, and he was located out there in the far western part of the world. It is then only natural that the Greeks and later Romans began to associate this area with Atlas. In fact, this is why the ocean that sits to the far west of Greece was already by the 6th century BC, some 2600 years ago, was called the Atlantic Sea, or the Sea of Atlas. The 5th century BC historian Herodotus used the term to describe the waters past the Pillars of Heracles, or as we call it today, the strait at the rocks of Gibraltar. That is the current Atlantic Ocean. And that's why the famous lost island out there beyond those pillars was also called Atlantis, or the Island of Atlas. At any rate, he is human enough for Heracles to need his help on one of his 12 labors, that is, the one where he had to retrieve the apples of the Hesperides, a mythical story that is known as early as the 6th century BC. The Hesperides, you may remember, were the goddesses of the evening and likewise located to the west, and they guarded the golden apples that were originally Zeus's wedding gift to Hera. Heracles was famous for having to travel the whole world to accomplish his last six labors, and this one was no different. But as it happens, Heracles had no idea where the Hesperides were, or how he could get the apples. So he was forced to ask Atlas to go and get them for him. But how? Atlas was holding up the heavens, so he told Heracles that he, Heracles, would have to hold up the sky while he, Atlas, went to get them. Heracles did so, and Atlas went off to retrieve the apples. When Atlas returned, he told Heracles the equivalent of, "Tough luck, dude," and was about to take off to deliver them to Eurystheus himself, when Heracles apparently asked Atlas to hold the heavens for just a sec while he got a pad for his head and shoulders. And for some dumb reason, this trick worked, and Atlas took over for that second, which turned into, well, forever, when Heracles took the apples and ran. Now, some of you might be wondering how a mere hero like Heracles was able to hold up the heavens. Well, apparently he didn't do it all by himself. On a famous sculpture on the Temple of Zeus in Olympia, the goddess Athena stands behind him and helps Heracles hold up the heavens as Atlas comes back with the apples. You can visit our dedicated website, manto-myth.org/GMF, to see a picture of what remains of the sculpture and other cool statues depicting this labor of Heracles. But let's get back to Atlas himself. Elsewhere, he is not a mythical giant with human features, but rather the mountain itself. In fact, the 5th century Greek historian Herodotus only knows Atlas as the mountain at the southwestern edge of the world.
Near to the salt hill is a mountain called Atlas, whose shape is slender and conical, and it is said to be so high that its heights cannot be seen, for clouds are always on them, winter and summer. The people of the country call it the Pillar of Heaven. These men get their name, which is Atlantes, from this mountain. It is said that they eat no living creature and see no dreams in their sleep. I know and can tell the names of all the peoples that live on the ridge as far as the Atlantes, but no farther than that. But I know this, that the ridge reaches as far as the pillars of Heracles and beyond them.
Herodotus' language indicates that he had never seen the mountain himself, but he identifies the mountain as the Pillar of Heaven. That is, he uses the same language that the poets had for the mythical giant. This is probably a version of the ancient interpretive strategy called rationalization, whereby the fantastical elements of a myth are removed in order to create a version that is historically plausible. We discussed this rationalization in an earlier episode. Here, Herodotus replaces the story about a human-like figure holding up the heavens with the mountain itself, and the mountain's height makes it very plausible that it indeed was holding up the heavens on its lofty peak. Several hundred years later, in the Roman imperial period, knowledge about the mountain itself was furthered by expeditions by Roman generals and others to the mountain and in some cases beyond. Pliny the Elder, who wrote a massive encyclopedia that contains geographical accounts of the world, tells us that, even with more knowledge, the mountain remains a source of fantastical stories.
Mount Atlas, which is the subject of much of the most marvelous stories of all the mountains in Africa. It is reported to rise into the sky out of the middle of the sands, a rugged eminence covered with crags on the side facing towards the coast of the ocean to which it has given its name, but shaded by dense woods and watered by gushing springs on the side facing Africa, where fruits of all kinds spring up of their own accord with such luxuriance that pleasure never lacks satisfaction. It is said that in the daytime none of its inhabitants are seen, and that all is silent, with a terrifying silence like that of the desert, so that a speechless awe creeps into the hearts of those who approach it, and also a dread of the peak that soars above the clouds and reaches the neighborhood of the moon's orb. Also, that at night this peak flashes with frequent fires and swarms with the wanton gambols of goatpans and satyrs, and echoes with the music of flutes and pipes and the sound of drums and cymbals. These stories have been published by celebrated authors, in addition to the labors performed in this region by Heracles and Perseus.
As with many places that sit on the edges of the known world, Mount Atlas is a subject of all sorts of fabulous, even magical stories. There is an eerie silence about the mountain that soars from the sands, above the clouds, and even up to the moon. Light dances on its peak, strange, wild creatures haunt the area, and ecstatic music of wild revelry resounds. Yes, strange things indeed happen at the ends of the earth. Pliny ends his account by referencing the myths of Heracles and Perseus that are associated with Atlas. We've already discussed the myth involving Heracles earlier, but we've been saving the second, that of Perseus, until now. That's because it is only in this myth of Perseus do we find a human-like Atlas changed into the mountain of the same name. The only full account of the metamorphosis of Atlas is found in the brilliant poet Ovid in his Metamorphoses, whom we've been dealing with extensively over the past few episodes. Ovid's account of Atlas is inventive and is an original take on the Atlas myth. In Ovid, Atlas is of superhuman size, in Ovid's words, outstripping all men with his huge body. He was a king in the distant west, who received the panting, tired horses of the sun, and his claim to fame was twofold: his thousands of flocks and herds that he pastured, and his glorious golden tree that bore golden fruit. But there's a problem. Years ago, Atlas had received a foreboding prophecy from the goddess Themis, who once gave oracles from Mount Parnassus before Apollo took over that job.
There will come a time, Atlas, a time when your tree will be robbed of its gold, and the son of Jupiter will claim the fame of this theft.
Worried about this, Atlas fortified his land, building a giant wall around his orchard, and put a giant serpent on guard to help him ward off all foreign visitors. If this sounds like the apples of the Hesperides, which was also guarded by a sleepless serpent, then you're right. But note that the golden fruit here does not belong to the Hesperides, but to Atlas himself. Rather than the fetcher of the golden apples, he's the owner, and he means to keep them for himself. Now, all of this, the prophecy, was in Atlas's mind when Perseus arrived fresh off his successful defeat of the Gorgon Medusa. He'd been flying for a whole day, the drops of blood from Medusa's head creating a massive number of serpents when they hit the sands of North Africa. And all Perseus wanted to do was to rest for just a little while. So when he saw Atlas and his realm, he decided to ask for a place to lay his weary head, and, well, Medusa's too, I suppose. And of course, Perseus is the son of Jupiter and tells Atlas just that. And this ought to be a point in his favor. What host, after all, would in their right mind reject a son of the king of the gods? But in this case, it backfired. Atlas was fearful of the prophecy and said essentially, "No way, Buster," and started to use his physical superiority to drive Perseus off. Perseus begged Atlas to stop, but to no avail. Atlas was just too strong. So Perseus resorted to his old, wearied trick. He turned his head aside and showed Atlas Medusa's head, turning the shepherd into the mountain that would bear his name. As Ovid tells it,
"Well now, since you show me so little kindness, accept a gift." And turning away himself, he held out Medusa's foul head on his left-hand side. Atlas became a mountain, as huge as he himself had been. Now his hair and beard were changed into trees, his shoulders and hands into ridges. What had been his head before was the crest on the mountain summit. His bones became stones. Then he grew to an immense height in every direction, so you gods determined. And the whole sky, with its many stars, rested on him.
So it turns out Atlas was not of such massive size already to support the heavens, but the gods had to make Atlas grow so as to be the pillar upon which the stars and sky rest. Tragically, the prophecy that a son of Jupiter was going to rob Atlas of his golden apples was actually in reference to Heracles, another son of Jupiter, and not Perseus. With Atlas now an immovable part of the landscape, Heracles can presumably just waltz in and get the apples for himself, as is told in some versions of the myth where he does not need Atlas's help. As it happens, Ovid is not the first ancient author to give this version of the story. By chance, we find in a late 12th century commentary to a very difficult ancient poem, a very interesting debate about Atlas. The commentator writes that Atlas was a Libyan mathematician, geographer, and astronomer who climbed up a mountain to better observe the stars, only to fall into the sea below, thus giving both his name. This might sound ludicrous, but one of the strategies of rationalizers of myth was to claim that people of olden times just made important advances in knowledge and were therefore mythologized into great heroes. In fact, we have a neat report that Heracles' meeting with Atlas was actually about the transfer of knowledge of astronomy. A 4th century mythographer named Herodorus writes, quote, "Heracles, who had become a seer and philosopher, received from the barbarian Atlas the Phrygian the pillars of the cosmos," which simply means that he received the knowledge of heavenly phenomena through instruction, end quote. At any rate, the commentator goes on to report that the poet Polyidos, probably from the 4th century BC also, made Atlas a shepherd who was turned to stone when he pestered Perseus with too many questions and would not let him pass through his land. This version is so similar to Ovid's that Ovid must have known the story, making a few final adjustments to fit his own poetic needs. I cannot help but bring in another rationalized version of this myth, one found in both a Greek text from the 1st century AD and in a late Latin commentary to Virgil's Aeneid that dates to around 400 AD. It too involves sheep and a shepherd, and is a play on the fact that the Greek words for sheep and apples, mela, sound the same. Okay, here's the gist of it. The Hesperides are the daughters of Atlas, and according to the basic myth, they had a garden with golden apples that were protected by a giant serpent. But Heracles was able to kill the dragon and take the apples. Note here again that there is no mention of Atlas's help. However, this basic story, we are told, is just a mythologized version of a normal set of circumstances. The truth here is that the Hesperides were just wealthy women who owned a lot of flocks, and the sheep's wool was of a reddish-gold color. In charge of the sheep was a shepherd named Drachone, which, of course, like the Slytherin Draco Malfoy in Harry Potter, means serpent. So here, he's not a real serpent, just a guy named Serpent. Heracles came to these pastures, killed Dracone, the guy, and took the mela, that is the sheep. But because of the goldish color of the sheep's wool, people started saying that Heracles took golden mela, and by a mistaken language, people thought that meant golden apples and not sheep. This is yet another attempt to downplay the fantastic version of the mythical stories in favor of a more pedestrian, dare I say realistic version of events. It also, like most rationalizing versions of myths, explains that myths themselves are just a distortion based on the misunderstanding of events or language. Draco is not a real serpent, just a guy named Snake. So when people heard mela, they thought apples and not sheep, and hence the myth. Now, Atlas's importance did not end in antiquity. He remained an image or idea that still resonates today. Despite the decisive turn to GPS navigation and digital maps, many of you may nonetheless own an atlas, which is simply a collection of maps. It's really hard to overstate how important these collections of maps were to the pre-GPS period. Okay, young listeners, don't judge me. I know I'm really old, but I'll say this. If you've not learned how to navigate by physical map, you might want to practice it. What happens when you lose service or the battery of your phone runs out? My advice is that every car should have a road atlas as a backup, and just looking at maps gives you a very different and broader sense of geography. In fact, the GPS way of looking at the world as a series of points takes us back in time and is, I would argue, something of a regression to a hodological approach of space, that is point A to point B, instead of a bird's eye view. Okay, enough of my soapbox screed. But why is a collection of maps called an atlas? Well, it goes back about 425 years when a map maker named Gerardus Mercator created a massive book that included historical, astronomical, and geographical studies with over 100 plates, including a lot of maps. The title on the frontispiece was Atlas Sive Cosmographicae Meditationes de Fabrica Mundi et Fabricati Figura, or for those of you without Latin, Atlas, or Cosmographical Reflections on the Creation of the World and the Shape of that Creation. This title is accompanied by a large bearded figure with two globes, one in his hands and another at his feet. This is, of course, derived from the ancient idea that Atlas was an astronomer and geographer before he was the guy who held the heavens on his back. But this image and title set the course for over 400 years of collections bearing the name Atlas. Eventually, the image disappeared, but the name remained. You may have also heard of the guy Mercator, since he was one of the earliest geographers to create a specific projection of the spherical Earth onto a two-dimensional surface, the so-called Mercator projection. For those listeners who want to see images of these early atlases, as well as other images of Atlas, take a look at our website, manto-myth.org/GMF. Well, it's about time to wrap up this episode, but let's consider one more way in which Atlas has influenced the modern world. It has to do with bodybuilding. And it starts with a young immigrant from Italy named Angelo Siciliano, a scrawny kid from southern Italy who settled in Brooklyn. Constantly bullied by bigger kids, one day he was walking by statues of Zeus and Heracles at the Brooklyn Museum where he got an idea. I want to look like that. So he started a program of strength training and worked tirelessly to build his body to counter the constant bullying. Using nothing more than his body weight, Angelo got so muscular through isometric training that other kids started calling him Atlas after a statue on top of Curly's Atlas Hotel in Queens, a New York institution. And the name stuck, as did his more Americanized first name, Charles. So after Charles Atlas emerged from his skinny cocoon into a beefy butterfly, he did several odd jobs, including steady work in leatherworking until he was discovered by the artist and wealthy socialite Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. The Vanderbilts and Whitneys were big deals in the Northeast. When Vanderbilt Whitney asked him to disrobe and pose for her, she apparently said, "He's a knockout," and soon Atlas was posing constantly for cameras and artists. but his claim to fame was the insanely successful mail-order exercise business that he would create some years later with his partner Charles Roman, selling his exercise routine called Dynamic Tension. We don't have enough time to cover Atlas's incredible life and legacy, which helped create the craze of physical health and bodybuilding, but we do provide some links to articles on his life on our website. Well, we've come to the end of this episode, but there are some people to thank. First, I'd like to thank our voice actor, Raina Burke, for bringing a living voice to the ancient texts we've chosen for our program on Atlas. Raina is a double major in environmental conservation and sustainability, as well as in the humanities. I'd also like to thank Beatrice Madison, a classics major, who has provided us with another piece of original art based on the figure Atlas. We hope you enjoy it. Finally, we'd like to thank Jared Sims, that's Sims with one M, who has generously allowed us to use his fine jazz piece Brooklyn Tea for our theme music. Serendipitously, the same Brooklyn where Charles Atlas grew up. Well, that's it for another episode of the Greek Myth Files. This is Scott Smith. We'll see you next time.